The following program contains views and opinions that do not necessarily reflect those of KMRE staff or of the Spark Museum of Electrical Invention.
Now, I just think this is a circumstance where we need to listen, that educators should educate, and they should not be foisted upon this responsibility of packing heat in first grade classes. Now, I understand you have suggested this, and we suggest things, and sometimes then we listen to people about it, and maybe they don't look so good a little later. So I just suggest we need a little less tweeting here, a little more listening, and let's just take that off the table and move forward.
It's Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contours, and what you just heard was a brief clip of our Washington State Governor Jay Inslee giving some lip to the President of the United States. We're going to get into that a little further down the road. I'd like to welcome Dave Willingham and Tim Johnson back into the studio. Hi, guys.
Hey.
You have been missed. And our special guest this week, Bellingham Police Department Chief Dahl. And welcome, Chief Dahl.
Thank you. And you can call me David. Stephanie?
It's hard. and people who know me know that I have a hard time not seeing your name as Deputy Dahl, one word, but I'm going to avoid that. Thank you, David. Chief Dahl. Since the Florida shooting, there have been dozens of incidents at schools around the country, including a developing situation at Bainbridge High School, which the last I heard was on lockdown. There have been some local threats at local schools, and we are going to talk with Chief Dahl about those issues, also emergency preparedness, hate groups, and the initiative that could change policing in Washington State. But first, it's been a while since we've had any Ledge update. Things are moving fast. Tim, I'm just going to throw it to you. I know there's a big issue. Tim wants me
throw it to Dave. Dave is the best on this.
The legislature has accomplished a lot. They've passed a ban on bump stocks. They've made a lot of progress in just a couple of weeks, and they stepped on a rake. And just about every newspaper in the state has come out against their actions last week. We talked earlier, a couple episodes ago, about the lawsuit that was filed by a coalition of news agencies against the state legislature because the state legislature had decided that they were not subject to the Public Records Act that was passed by initiative in the 70s. And the court said, actually, you are, as laid out in the text of the Public Records Act. And the legislature's decision on that, that happened back in January, and it's under appeal by the legislature to the state Supreme Court. The legislature has decided to act, and with incredible alacrity, they passed a really, really, really unpopular bill that not only shields everything prior to July 1st of this year. None of that is publicly accessible. None of it can be requested under the existing act. Everything from that point forward is going to have a lot of special limitations, and they've made some very strange changes. So
Let me ask you guys, for anybody who, like me, may have tuned out the minute you said public disclosure, can you break it down as to why does Joe Public care about this? What does it mean for us?
Well, I would say that the public, some years back, I think in the 1970s, in an initiative, said that they wanted these disclosures. So Washington State has one of the most generous public disclosure requirements in the nation. It's and it is part of that idea, the concept, and it's framed in the state constitution, the consent of the governed. And the governed deliver their consent because they're informed off the other end. There's very broad and generous disclosure. And I think in this case, I think the concern here, and I talked to at least one representative about this.
You're not going to name names.
No, I'm not going to name names. But the concern was that this decision came down in January from Superior Court in Tacoma, and they were in the middle of their session, and they only have, and I don't think the public understands this, but you can only introduce a bill to a certain date in a legislative session. Then there's a cutoff on bills, and they were facing that that deadline, and so they had to scramble. And I think the optics on this are very bad. I have to weigh in on my alongside my colleagues in the news profession that they shouldn't have done what they did. They shouldn't have just unilaterally foreclosed. But I think I understand some of the motives. Some of the motives, some of the concerns from the legislature was that somebody could do a public disclosure request and get private information from people that are requesting information from their representative. Somebody could get information that they could gin up into a smear campaign in an election year.
So can I throw in an example? Because what's coming to my mind is Senator Doug Erickson and the lobbying money and who he went to lunch with and how many lunches and who paid for those lunches. Is that something that would be covered or not covered in this?
Well, that would depend on the ruling of he's in the Senate, and I don't remember in the House. It's the Rules Committee in the Senate. It's a, I don't remember the committee. And to determine, to adjudicate that, and if you don't like the result, you can appeal to them again. But there is no judicial backing for this like there is in the Public Disclosure Act. And Tim's absolutely right. Public disclosure is a value we have here in Washington State, and it's one that's very important to a lot of us. And the Public Disclosure Act affects the state, it affects the county, it affects the city, it is every municipality. Everyone is subject to the same rules except for the legislature. And, you know, it seems like a decade ago, but I'm sure some people remember when Jeb Bush announced he was going to run for president, he said, I'm going to be the most transparent person ever, and he released all of his correspondence with his constituents from when he was governor, and he did not redact phone numbers, really deeply personal information, Social Security numbers from any of it, because I don't know. But the, you know, there are protections built into the Public Records Act, and rather than look at those and say, do those meet our needs, like they meet the needs of every other municipality in the state legislature decided, we're not going to bother. We are going to specifically exempt ourselves. And there's a huge campaign right now, more than 4,000 calls today, more than 8,000 emails to the governor to get him to veto this. He has until tomorrow.
Oh, my gosh.
And
yeah. And this is the Wednesday show.
Yeah. And he's
you want to call him.
And I think they, not to dwell on it too long, but I think that they were in a panic because I think that the Superior Court ruling kind of threw the whole thing wide open. And let me put it this way. There are two circles. There are people that probably are trying very hard not to have unsavory laundry aired. They don't really want their laundry aired through some massive public disclosure in an election year. Let's put those there. And then I think that there is another circle of people that have very legitimate concerns that people that have contacted them for information or whatnot, they are suddenly targeted and that they become part of a mailing list in some fishing expedition for whatever dirt somebody wants to get on a candidate in an election year. And I think that the idea was that this Superior Court ruling kind of threw it wide open.
Which it did not. I mean, there are protections in the Public Disclosure Act that exist now. And I have seen a couple of statements from legislators around the state who very clearly do not understand the existing law. And I think the best thing that could happen here is that Jay Inslee vetoes this and gives the legislature a chance to think, do we want to move forward with this or do we want to do this right?
And I completely agree with that.
Well, and I will say we are in one of the most feisty independent states, and the reason that we have this PDC, this public disclosure campaign, is because we as a state strongly believe in the right to know, and we'll see how that plays out. But let's talk about Inslee for a moment longer. What exactly happened, Dave? Set up the clip we're about to hear.
So the president hosted a bunch of governors at the White House to have a talk, and among the items that came up, of course, were the recent school shooting in Florida and the seemingly endless, unstoppable cascade of such events that have struck coast to coast in this country. And given the opportunity to speak, our governor had some strong words for the president.
What percentage it is, I heard at one time you might have suggested 20%. whatever percentage it is, speaking as a grandfather,
right,
speaking as a governor of the state of Washington, I have listened to the people who would be affected by that. I've listened to the biology teachers, and they don't want to do that at any percentage. I've listened to the first grade teachers that don't want to be pistol packing first grade teachers. I've listened to law enforcement who have said they don't want to have to train teachers as law enforcement agencies, which takes about 6 months. Now, I just think this is a circumstance where we need to listen, that educators should educate, and they should not be foisted upon this responsibility of packing heat in first grade classes. Now, I understand you have suggested this, and we suggest things, and sometimes then we listen to people about it, and maybe they don't look so good a little later. So I just suggest we need a little less tweeting here, a little more listening, and let's just take that off the table and move forward.
Jay Inslee speaking this week to the President of the United States at the Governor's Conference about listening more and tweeting less, and really responding to 45's edict that maybe we should arm teachers as a way to slow down school shootings. This is an excellent time to reintroduce our guest, Chief David Dahl, who has been with the Bellingham Police Department since the 80s. And congratulations on being the chief.
Thank you very much. This was a great civil discussion here. I didn't have to jump between these two guys and keep the peace either. They did a great job.
Is that why you think we have you here?
I think it's great. That's... Maybe. I'm not sure.
Well, let me just say this. Chief Dahl and I have worked together before, full disclosure. We have certainly had very lively conversations, and we'll probably do so in the next 45 minutes. It's wonderful that you're here and that you are the kind of person that you will just engage with people and you'll have dialogue with people. Also, I just want to say, before I get into giving you any hard time, it is a hard time to be a police officer, and it's got to be a hard time to be the chief of police.
It is difficult. I want to back up a few moments and talk about you for just a minute, because you're not just someone that we've had discussions with. You are a valued member of our law enforcement family. I will tell our listeners that Stephanie was once a member of our community advisory council and left there, I believe, due to some scheduling issues, but she remains a part of what we call our BPD Futures Group. You've helped us to define our mission, our vision, our values. You helped us to select the proper words to help express the principles that we think are important in our culture and in the organization that we do here in Bellingham. And so you are part of our family. And I guess I can be your brother, you could be my sister, and we can have a little bit of a sibling rivalry or something like that. But go for it.
Well, thank you for those kind words, and my credibility as an independent journalist has been just blown out the window. But hey, let's go back to the real issue, because seriously, since Florida, since what happened just a week ago, there have been copycat incidents everywhere. We had an issue at Blaine High School. We had a threat at Ferndale High School. As we were going on the air tonight, there was something developing at Bainbridge, and... there's been a lot of suggestions about what should be handled differently. But first, I want to ask you, how is the Bellingham Police Department prepared?
There are a lot of ideas out there on how to handle this horrific. It's horrific. Every time we see it on TV, every time we hear about it, it's just absolutely devastating for all of us. The Bellingham Police Department has been training for such a tragedy for several years now. Columbine, as you remember, was a game changer in terms of police tactics and how we handle school shootings. Back in the day, it was, contain the area, wait for the SWAT team to come in. Columbine taught us that we need to get in there and neutralize the threat as quickly as possible. And that changed police training, thankfully. Secondly, when we had the Colorado movie massacre, that was a paradigm shift for medics, in that they had patients there, viable patients that they were losing. So now, as we enter the danger zone, as we enter the hot zone, the warm zone, whatever you want to call it, we're taking medical personnel and protecting them and getting them there to those patients as quickly as possible. In Bellingham right now, we do what we call active shooter training. We do it at schools, we do it at places like the mall, we do it at places where people will congregate. And we practice those tactics. We practice what we call hasty command, in terms of getting officers there right away, getting them into the scene, getting another group of officers there to help to organize the onslaught of help that we get. If we get an active shooter report, believe me, agencies from all over Whatcom County, including our federal partners, are going to respond and help. And you have to manage those incoming resources as well to make sure that things run smoothly, as well as medical care, as well as families, as well as the press. It's huge. And we practice that both at the tactical level and at the command level. We talk to our schools in terms of training and best practices for them to perform in these instances. And we try to think creatively about ways that we can partner with the school district to not only have more of a law enforcement presence, not just to have an armed presence, but to have officers there that are building relationships with kids. We have some ideas about that. Back in the day, we talked earlier before the show, we used to have several officers in our schools, back in the DARE program or the GREAT program or just school resource officers. That was funded by grants that have since gone away, and unfortunately, those positions went away as well. Now we don't have that grant money, but we do have a desire to want to make a difference. So we're looking at potentially finding ways that officers could, on their downtime, spend some time in the schools, visiting with the students, maybe teaching civics classes, maybe hanging out, playing basketball, whatever, but just creating those relationships and helping the community to feel safe.
Well, regardless of how those DARE officers and that program was or was not efficient, which is a story for another show, they were armed officers in the schools. One of the ideas that has been suggested is having an armed officer at the door of every school. And one of the ideas that's been suggested, as we just heard, is about arming teachers. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to hear your response to both.
Well, you know, here's the problem with that, okay? And I take this back to a concept that I have that some people frown when I say it, don't understand it. But if I had enough money to put a police officer in everybody's front yard, we're in trouble because nobody's watching the back, right? Having more and more and more police officers out there is not the answer. I think the answer lies in having a bit of a watered down approach, but let's get the school systems engaged in understanding their students who are at risk. I was just at Bellingham Technical College this morning meeting with their behavioral intervention team. And this is a school that if there is a student that might be having some problems, they interact with that individual. They assess that individual. They reach out and try to provide resources to that individual. I understand that there's a bill in our state to help fund such a program so that students can anonymously or in some type of a system report maybe suspicious activity on fellow students. But getting more of a community approach to this problem and not just saying, let's put an armed police officer there, but as a community, let's take care of each other. Let's detect when there's a problem. If you see someone, we know the people that are in our schools. They know the people that are in our schools better than we do, I should say. The students, the fellow teachers. If they have a mechanism in place where they can identify someone who may need some help, let's start there.
Well, it sounds like your thrust would be, or your approach would be, to try to normalize the public's interaction with police officers, uniformed police officers, so that when a uniformed police officer is in their presence, that this is a normal thing and actually a beneficial thing, and that the public feels that they're safe in approaching that officer.
You know, that was, I think, one of the benefits of the DARE program and the GREAT program. Let's put the curriculum aside. People have opinions about that. But just the opportunity for kids to interact with law enforcement officers, you know, when they're not in trouble, or just opportunities to spend time meeting an officer, getting to know them as a person, that has actually created lifelong relationships for us as we interact with those folks when they're adults and they come to us and say, hey, you were my DARE officer. You taught me these things, or just gained a healthy respect for each other. That's the key, I think.
Well, and I think that's a focus of community policing, and we're going to get into that larger issue. But I don't want to leave the issue of schools and school preparedness just yet. I think it's too much on everybody's minds. We really don't know, or at least people like me who don't have kids, who are not connected with the schools. I live pretty close to one of the high schools, and I don't know how prepared that school is. Mm-hmm.
So is that a question?
Yeah,
we work with the school district. We help them with anything that they want from us. I know that the school district has an emergency manager that we work. In fact, he was in our office yesterday talking about potential best practices that we can continue working with the school and how they respond to armed intruders or problems in their particular campuses.
And I do want to say it's not your city, but your neighbor city of Ferndale, it seemed like there was a very fast coordinated good effort when that threat was called in, and it seemed like a lot of teams worked well together. Would you say, in terms of emergency, different teams, do you think that you guys are in a good place with?
Yeah, we train together.
Yeah.
And in fact, one of the campuses in Ferndale is an empty school, and we actually have gone there and done some training within that school. So we work together. We also work with our federal partners too. So if they show up, they understand what we're doing.
And how would you have to change? How would the police department have to change if every or even a third of the teachers were armed? Would anything be different?
Well, there'd be more armed people on campuses that need to be identified by us. And so we would have to have some type of system in place where we can quickly differentiate the threats from the good guys.
So Tim brought up the idea of community policing. I'm gonna jump ahead and let's get into that. As you outed me earlier, I was part of the team that worked on your mission statement, your current mission committed to community. Mm. And community policing has taken hold in many parts of the country as being sort of a kinder, gentler way of interacting with the community. Now that you've worked with that mission for a while, Chief Dahl, how would you say that is being put into action?
Well, community policing was huge in the 90s, huge in the beginning, because there's a lot of funding out there. And President Clinton's 100,000 new police officers, I mean, they poured a lot of funding. In fact, I was traveling around the United States with the Federal Law Enforcement Training Program teaching community policing and problem solving, because there's a lot of money out there. And then it went away. And that's when you found the organizations that really treated it as a philosophy and not just a program. Because if it's a philosophy that is part of who you are, and it's an understanding that the police alone cannot solve crime problems, that it takes a collective effort of the community, it takes an understanding of what the underlying conditions are of problems, and then working together to solve those problems, that's the key to it. It's organizational change, it's problem solving, and it's partnerships. That's what community policing is all about.
So put it into more of a micro. What's changed in the Bellingham Police Department since you've made that your motto?
I think we do. Well, committed to community was a mission statement that we just adopted about 2 years ago when we had this big, huge 4-hour training session on let's have a new mission statement because we had a new chief of police. And every new chief of police likes a new mission statement. So I set up this 4-hour session. And I think we came up with that mission statement in the first 20 minutes.
To be fair, it was an anonymous note that was left in a suggestion box in your department.
In our records.
And we still don't know who is responsible for that.
You know, my understanding of that, if I can give a little background on that, the mayor was very vocal about the difference between what I'm going to use the words that they're probably incorrect, but front-end policing and back-end policing. And back-end policing would be like a business has been broken into, a store has been robbed, there's been a crime against a person, and you stack your priorities on back-end policing. Front-end policing is you're in the community, you're seen through the public, the neighborhood sees that there's an officer in the community and that it has an effect on the crime rate in the community. I know I haven't used the proper words, but am I correct in that?
You did very well there. I think community policing is a lot of things, and I love Mayor Kelly. I love our council because public safety for them is a priority. And there's an understanding that we don't want to be an organization that has police officers out there that are just running from call to call to call to call. And there are organizations that are like that. It's very stressful and there's no downtime. And so you have no time to pull over and talk to people who are in a park or walking down the road or just getting out and spending time with the community when they're not in crisis. What that means is it means that we take a look at a staffing model that is set on our workload. And then you work towards what we call this 50-50 split of obligated and unobligated time. We would like for every hour of time an officer to have at least half of that amount of time unobligated to be able to go out and do community policing efforts such as hang out in the school and do a civics class for an hour, or spend some time in a park, or go down to Maritime Heritage and walk through that area and just talk to people. It also means collaborating in things that we do. We would not have put together our mission, vision, values if we didn't include our Community Advisory Council or we didn't include Stephanie. We are about to launch our strategic plan to City Council next month. That is an effort that comes from within our organization and in collaboration with our community members as well.
Is this your mission as a police chief? You said every chief needs a mission and a statement.
I don't know what it is because I think one of the questions of how's the Dave Dahl era going to be defined, I think it's going to be when Dave Dahl leaves and how he's remembered. But I've worked alongside six different police chiefs and for the last three police chiefs as a deputy chief. So everything that we pushed forward in terms of our administration, I have worked on pushing as well. So I think that it's not me. It's just kind of the way we've been for the last many years.
So a lot of people who live in this country don't have a very good relationship with their local police. A lot of people live in areas where they can't interact with their police in a, you know, just normal everyday manner. And what are we doing differently? Why is this, you know, different here?
What a great question that is, because I hear that there are people that are afraid to come to us, whether it's from experiences they've had with us, maybe in other countries that they've come from, and they simply don't trust the police. And that concerns me. One of the things that we've done to address that, as an example, and in full disclosure, I am on the advisory board of the Whatcom Dispute Resolution Center, but we have been working with Moonwater and that group to find out, maybe they can come to you, and you could kind of be an ombudsman-like approach or just a safe place to forward any complaints or any police reports. We're exploring that right now. And in fact, we're exploring it citywide for all city services. That is something that one of the projects that the mayor's working on. I have gone to many community meetings, but you're not talking about those because those are folks that feel comfortable going there.
Right.
We are working with potentially next year with Malcolm Oliver, who is one of our advisors, who does a lot of outreach with different communities and tries to get law enforcement out to those communities, like the Sikh community, like the Hispanic community, like the Russian community. And that's something that we would like to do. We're working on an expanded outreach program right now with our neighborhood police officers to try to find connections into those communities so we can go out to them. I spent yesterday after work at the Northwest Youth Services because I wanted to hear from a community of kids who might feel uncomfortable talking to the police. So I dressed down in my jeans and a shirt and went and had tacos with them. Only three kids came in and talked to me, and there were more out there that wanted to. And I told the executive director, let's do this again. But finding ways that we can go out and do some outreach to those groups so they can feel comfortable telling their story to me or to our officers about why they're apprehensive about making that connection. And then for us, finding ways to make that connection happen every day.
You are listening to Cascadia News Now. That is Chief David Dahl, our new police chief of Bellingham, Washington. I'm Stephanie Contours. Also in the studio are my co-host Tim Johnson and Dave Willingham. And you are listening to KMRE 102.3 FM Bellingham and 102.5 KAVZ Deming Van Zandt. And we also welcome KPNW-DB if you are listening on the web. So let's follow up. We've been talking about community policing. And when you talk, Chief Dahl, you have this kind avuncular way about you of, I'm going to go and I'm going to dress down and I'm going to hang out with the kids. And I think what Dave was starting to get at is, You perceive it that way, but there are people who don't perceive it that way. As friendly and as kind as an officer may be or may believe themselves to be, you alluded to people who have had bad experiences and people who, let's be fair, are currently having bad experiences for whatever reasons. We don't have to get into that. But I guess my concern with community policing is that there's this idea of normalizing, but there's a concomitant idea that the more police officers there are, the more we become a police state. And I don't know how you balance those out, but you're seeing friendly police officers around the neighborhood as a great normalizing thing. And there are people who see that as a threat and dangerous. Hmm. I mean, I'm sure you've read 1984. This is not new to you.
I'll just speak for myself. I'm sweating bullets here because you're in the room. You know, I am a person who is poorly socialized in general, but for police especially. And there have been times where I have needed to talk to a police officer, and my own previous problems have made that difficult.
Well, I will certainly, if you have any suggestions on how we can help to fill that gap, I'm all ears, truly, in any environment you'd like, because I think that's important for me. I'm not suggesting we need a whole bunch of more police officers. What I'm suggesting is that we have enough so that our officers can spend time having some quality interactions with people. I know that there are people that have had, I found this out, you know, yesterday when I was at Northwest Youth Services. I was told there was a young man who wanted to come, but he just was frightened. And so maybe the kids that were there can reach out to him and say, you know, I talked to Dave Dahl, and perhaps maybe I can sit with you and you can talk to him too and you won't be so frightened. I get it. There's people that have had experiences. I don't know what yours were give us an opportunity. One of the things that happens, especially with policing, is that we get painted with a very broad brush. So when you see bad policing somewhere, and there's bad policing out there, the first question you ask, and you should ask, is that how policing gets done in Bellingham? And we can have that conversation. And so we've said time and time again, get to know us, get to know what we're about, get to know how we do business.
Well, that raises an interesting point, and it's something that I intended to do at the beginning of the show, but I wanted to congratulate you on your promotion to Chief of Police of Bellingham. And maybe the context is your background, because you grew up in Bellingham, you went to school in Bellingham, you beat the streets in Bellingham, and you rose up through the ranks and are now Chief of Police. It's often the case that somebody from outside is promoted into the realm of Chief of Police. What do you think your experience in Bellingham, how do you think that is going to influence your approaches and ability to be the Chief of Police of Bellingham, that local connection?
I love Bellingham. I love this community. I love everything about it. I've seen it change throughout the years. I care deeply about how our officers treat our community members. My family lives in this, my mom and my dad live in this community, my sister and my brother live in this community. And, you know, I just care deeply about it. I really do. I think that we have a very special place. And I think one of the reasons why we have a very special place is because we have a very good police department. We really do.
Well, that's, you know, you talked about there is bad policing out there. And,
yes.
You know, a couple of years ago, I was at, I believe it was Shared Hope, an anti-sex trafficking training here in Bellingham. And one of the things that they talked about was one of the tools that they use is they destroy people, their victims' ability to trust police. And, you know, I thought about it and I thought, you know, I could probably spend half an hour with someone on YouTube and do exactly that. So what is Bellingham doing to keep people who shouldn't be police officers from becoming officers?
What a great question. Because we don't just take anybody. And a quick story, when I tested for this position, it was back in 1983, and the written test was at a lecture hall at Western because there were about 300 people competing for the job. Now we're lucky if we can get about 30 that want to show up. And so one of the things that we have to do is we have to use more of a regional testing approach, and people can compete for several departments. They can check the Bellingham box, or they can check the Anacortes box. But that doesn't mean they automatically get hired. We go through a very stringent background process. And one of the important things that we look at is what is an individual's connection to Bellingham, especially if they're coming to us from another part of the country, or if they're coming to us from another department and already trained. We like to have other officers from other departments work for us. Quite frankly, it saves a lot of money in sending them to the academy, but it's very important that they learn the culture of our organization and go through a very stringent training process. Now, when we have officers that act in a certain way that's counter to our culture, we take care of that problem. And I know that, you know, we just hit the news with, we have two officers that were arrested. We are in the process of dealing with those internally, and they will be held accountable for their actions.
So I brought this up to you before the show. There was a man shot last month who's a gay Jewish man, and it is coming out that he was part of something called the Atomwaffen, which is an extreme Nazi hate group that has ties in Washington State, in Skagit County, somebody who used to be in Bellingham. And I totally hear what you're saying. Oh, I love the community. We are known that you can just go to the Southern Poverty Law Center, and we are one of the hate group central areas. So somebody could come in, I love Bellingham, I love Whatcom County, and be a member of a hate group and maybe be able to hide it for a long time. So you're shaking your head.
Well, I don't, you know, I mean, any type, you can hide it. I mean, all of us in this room are biased. We all have our biases. We deal with that. We teach fair and partial policing. You know, you went through that course with me. But any explicit bias that we see or comes out is dealt with immediately. I do not want anybody working in this organization that does that. It's counter to our culture. One of those incidents can ruin our organization. You know, one of the things that I tell our officers when they get hired, and I talk to each and every one of them, they have to spend time with Dave, is that, you know, these badges that we wear are metal and they're heavy, and it's just weird to me that we walk around with this heavy piece of hunk of metal on our chest. But it's very, very symbolic, quite frankly, of the tremendous power and authority that police officers have. We're the only sanctioned group of individuals that can take away a person's freedom. We can take away a person's life. That's a huge amount of responsibility and power. That's why that badge is metal. But I also tell them that badge is also made of glass. And that glass represents the community trust. We break that, we shatter that trust. We break that badge. Quite frankly, we're done. And you've seen communities in this nation that have had that experience. And quite frankly, they're done. They have no trust over their law enforcement organizations. That's when you have federal consent decrees show up and you have the federal government running the police departments because the police departments can't adequately run themselves.
And trust is a funny thing. And I don't know if one community as a community can completely trust or distrust. I know that police are up against a lot. I brought that up at the Community Action Council that it doesn't matter who every or any individual officer is in Bellingham. Mm-hmm. We're not seeing how officers are, not when they're talking to me on the street, but when they're dealing with somebody in an alley in the middle of the night who might be a person of color. We don't know, which is why I think things like the incident that happened, I know you can't talk directly about it, but there was an incident. There are some very active voices who have protested the police department, who have brought forth accusations about bias. I know you had that one implicit bias training. But there's also an issue, and we've talked about it on the show, Motel 6 giving information to ICE, our own Washington Department of Licensing giving information to ICE. Mm-hmm. We've had a whole thing about Sanctuary City. I don't know if you want to weigh in, but because this incident happened, regardless of the incident itself, mm-hmm. I'd like you to speak to your attitude and what you're carrying forward with the Bellingham Police Department in terms of working or not working with Border Patrol or working with people who are documented or not documented.
Yeah, we have valued partnerships with the federal government, and we will continue to have that. We do not enforce civil immigration law. We don't enforce civil immigration warrants. And I do have a concern over an experience that Tukwila Police just had, where they had a particular warrant that looked criminal and turned out to be civil. So we're looking into that. I've asked Tukwila Police for those documents so that we can see them as well. And our organizational policy, which is on our website, reflects that. We went through this experience about this time last year with City Council and our legal department and a group of stakeholders that came in, and we worked on our policies together. One of the things that we do have that I think is helping us quite a bit to show our transparency is that we're the first police department in the state of Washington to mandate body-worn cameras for all of our officers. That's a program that I helped to push about 3 years ago, and it's an important program. And it's an expensive program, but I think it's well worth it. When we get complaints from folks, we look at the body-worn camera footage. Now, I've had experiences where people have complained and said, you know something, your officer stopped me because of my ethnicity. And I say, well, we'll take that very seriously. Let's look at the body-worn camera footage. And so we look at that footage and we look at the other seven people that that particular officer stopped within that 2 hour period of time. And he said the exact same thing to the same people, stopped them all for the exact same reason. And we could see on the camera that you couldn't tell the ethnicity of the individual because it was at night. I've also had someone come in and say, I want to report that your officer was really rude to my grandson. And my grandson might have mouthed off, but your officer is pretty darn rude to him. And my response was, okay, let's take a look at the body-worn camera footage. And we do, and the body-worn camera footage shows that, yeah, your grandson mouthed off at us, and yeah, we were a bit rude to that person. The cool thing about it was before I had even looked at that footage, the sergeant had seen that footage, and he'd held the officer accountable. He wrote him up for it. So action had already been taken, and I was able to go back to that community member and apologize for the organization, and I do that on occasion, and I say, we took care of the problem, and this is what we did. When people have concerns or complaints, they can always call me. I will always look into it. I will. You know, my number is easy to know. It's 911. No, don't call that number.
Wow.
But you can call my office, and I will always.
Let me put in a quick plug as the Mrs. Cratchit of my neighborhood that, because I live in the lettered streets, I'll just admit it, and we're an active neighborhood.
We have
an active night culture. And so.
And good potlucks every now and then.
And the occasional potluck. So 676. 6911, if you want to call the police, and it's not an emergency, it's an excellent number and it's easy to remember.
Yeah.
You know, and this harkens back to your history in Bellingham. You know, I've been covering the police for all my entire time as a journalist in Bellingham, and I've been noticing that there's a change in the sort of tenor of crime. I mean, when I first got involved, there was lots and lots of domestic violence, and that actually seems like, and I believe you were on a task force to look at those issues, domestic violence. Domestic violence in the 90s was like a major event for police, and a lot of puzzlement about how to address that and lots of work on that. And now it seems like the issue really coming to the forefront for Bellingham Police is how to deal with homeless populations, how to deal with transient and the acting out and those kinds of issues. Would you agree with me that's becoming like more and more a focus of Bellingham Police?
Well, first of all, domestic violence still is a huge priority for us.
Yes.
And we continue to find ways to ensure that we are helping people who are experiencing domestic violence through our social service agencies. Every officer that goes to a scene makes that connection with that phone with an advocate right then and there. Whether the person wants to or not, we give them the phone, they can hang up, but at least we make that point. So that continues to be a huge priority for us. I will say yes. The answer to your question is absolutely. You know, about 5 years ago, we were responding to about 400 times a year to people who were experiencing some type of crisis. And this is not a crime. This is not someone's going to go to jail. It's someone's acting out in such a way that a 911 call happens. And sometimes it's two officers, sometimes it's three, sometimes it's four, because people are truly out of control. And we have to help them to get into a safe place where they can get some help. About 400 times a year, about 5 years ago. Now we're about 700 of those calls a year. So we are seeing an increase in people who are out in crisis as a result of lack of appropriate medical care, mental health care, mental health help. It's atrocious that we can't find help for these folks. And we've become the default social service providers, and the jail, unfortunately, sometimes becomes the default location for mental health issues. So with that in mind, what are we doing about it? I think it's extremely important that we have in our organization as a priority, de-escalation training is huge for us. And I will proudly say again, we're the first state of Washington Police Department that has mandated de-escalation training from the chief on down to all of our officers. I've been through two different classes myself, and I ride a desk all day, you know, but it's important for me to know what the officers are learning. We do de-escalation training in every bit of our training because we want to get people safely into custody so we can get them the help that they need. But you're absolutely right. Dealing with folks that are experiencing homelessness, and you know, unfortunately, tonight is a night that the Fountain Church closes their doors. Humongous support and kudos to Fountain Church people who have, for the last 3 months, opened up their doors to a shelter for women and families because of the cold weather, and the 140 plus volunteers that they have gathered to do that. You know, God bless them.
Okay, you're not the chief of police. You're the king. You're the king. You're the king. And what would you do, like from top to bottom in this country, to deal with the issue of escalating mental health issues that impact our community and that police respond to?
Mental health. Help, whether it's more beds, whether it's more opportunities for people to have meaningful time in a mental health facility. You know, 5, 6, 7 days is not enough. And that's sometimes as long as you can hold somebody involuntarily. This is simply not enough. Our stakeholders who are in the business tell us that. So any monies that we can put towards that mental health help, whether it's hospitals, whether it's clinicians, whether it's whatever, not opioids, but just get out there and get people the help that they need.
Well, I want to go back. There's so many things I want to go back to. But let's talk for a second about de-escalation, because that leads us directly into Initiative 940. And I know you know about it, but for those who don't listen to our show religiously every week, and you should, the current situation in Washington State is that police are immunized against prosecution unless they have acted with malice in a fatal incident, in a fatal shooting. Malice has to be proven. It is impossible or almost impossible to prove malice in a shooting. And this initiative would make some pretty huge changes. One of the reasons it's important, I just want to say their names and bring up John Williams, John T. Williams, who is a 50-year-old carver of the New Chanuk First Nations, was shot 4 times by a Seattle police officer in 2010. And, of course, Charlena Lyles, who was a pregnant, mentally ill mother of 3, who was killed by 2 Seattle officers. And this initiative comes out of increased awareness of these situations and increased sort of horrific situations. What it would require is for police training for violence de-escalation, which you say the Bellingham Police Department is already doing. Mm-hmm. And first aid also requires police would give first aid at the scene, mm-hmm. removes the automatic immunity for officers. What it adopts is what's called a good faith standard for use of deadly force, which means there's a whole set of circumstances mm-hmm. which are supposedly more okay or more justifiable, including somebody who has escaped from jail or somebody who has committed or looks like they're going to commit a felony. It also requires independent investigations of use of deadly force and brings diverse community stakeholders to the table. Now, also includes tribal governments in investigations that involve a tribal person. Mm-hmm. Now, from what you've said over the past time that you're here, mm-hmm. sounds like the Bellingham Police Department is doing a lot of that already.
We are.
So how do you feel about this initiative?
how I feel about it.
Well, are you? Yeah.
Well, so let's, as a disclaimer, let me tell you that I can either support or oppose a ballot measure as the chief of police. I'll give you David Dahl's feelings on it, okay? And I agree with most of the principles that are in this initiative. Quite frankly, a lot of the stuff that's in the initiative is what we're doing right now. The de-escalation training, the first aid issues, I have no problem with taking malice out of the law, quite frankly, because, and I have no problem with the objective reasonableness standards that they have, because right now that's how we function in terms of our use of force review. You have to use a reasonably objective and necessary force, and all of those things are very much spelled out. And so I think the problem with the initiative, and I think because here's the dilemma, it's that if this is so good, why are these different police groups opposing it?
Exactly.
And I think that you taught me something. You teach me many lessons, Stephanie. But one of the things that you have taught me in the past is that words are important. And I think that some people are just getting a little bit freaked out at how it's written and how it's interpreted.
By some people, are you referring to police departments?
I'm referring to the groups that have opinions about this. Now, I have, for instance, I've asked several legal advisors. I'll give you an example. We all agree that the police should render aid to someone who's injured. Absolutely. It's in our policy manual. We do that. The initiative talks about it being a paramount duty. And so what the feedback that we get from some legal folks is, you know what that means, is that if it's a paramount duty, then if you have a situation like an active shooter, and officers are going in to neutralize the threat, but they come up to an injured person, they have to stop what they're doing, not neutralize the threat, and take care of that injured person. That's how some interpret it. So therefore, if you make it a paramount duty and use those words, we're going to have problems. Other legal advisors this way will say, that's silly,
right?
Absolutely silly. That's not reasonable. So I think that what you have is you have different folks that are looking at this initiative, and they're getting different interpretations of what it means. So I can control the Bellingham Police Department. I can control what we do. De-escalation training is an important thing for us. And by the way, if this initiative does go and it does mandate de-escalation training for police departments, please, please, please fund it, because it's very expensive. And you know, I do organizational assessments with the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs. I have gone to police departments and assessed their practices. It's not uncommon to see police departments that don't have training as a priority, and that's a shame. In our organization, it is. I've got three dedicated people. We have the ability to have three dedicated people that do training in our organization full time. Our police officers attend training at least one day a month. That's way above and beyond what the state standard is. The issue of malice, you know, I've talked about many legal advisors, and you know, as long as the officers are looking at that objective, reasonable standard, and using the necessary force, it's defined, we're fine. David Dahl, don't think it is a big deal.
So let's look at this aspect, and this ties back into community policing for me, which makes me very happy. Bringing diverse community stakeholders to the table for the development of standards. You could say you're already doing that with Citizen Action Council, but wait. Going back a moment to when you talked about you looking at body camera footage, and you went to talk to officers directly, and you are an honorable young man who's a police chief.
Young,
and
thank you for saying young.
You know, in order to get you to answer the question, Chief Dahl, but people who have critiques about community policing and the feel-good rhetoric of the term, and that's an accusation that's leveled at the term community policing, oh, look, it's got community in it, so police departments don't have to deal with anything. But one of the critiques is that there is not enough citizen oversight. This came up when I was in the Citizen Action Council, and the former police chief was really strongly against it. We had some pretty heated discussion about having a citizen board, whether or not that was a violation of confidentiality, and whether or not having the sheriff department or another police department down the road was really independent enough, because there's a perception that police are always going to stick together, like the military. Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts about citizen oversight?
Well, you know, I don't have enough information about the current citizen review boards that are out there in police departments, and I think that the other chief did, and that's one of the reasons why he was opposed to it in terms of their success. This is what I think. I think that, and I'm a huge fan of what's called an ombudsman approach, and that is, if you have an outside source who's learned in the law and police procedures, who ensures that any investigations are done, they're thorough, they're complete, everything has been investigated, and it can certify that investigation is being properly done. That sounds like a good idea to me. Right now, I think, you know, my oversight, quite frankly, especially in the last 3 months, has been the mayor and city council. I am always talking about what we're doing and why we're doing it, not only to the mayor, but to other city council members as well. So I think that the other thing about the initiative that you mentioned that I think is of concern to people is when you talk about the community stakeholders, it's undefined. And what does that mean when you tell a police department that before you change a policy, you must consult your community stakeholders? So that's another one of those words that are important that need to be narrowed down and defined, because who are our community?
Well, that can happen in a process of citizen oversight development. Dave, we have just a brief moment. I'm throwing to you.
Okay, I'm going to ask the biggest question of the night. So when that glass shatters,
yeah,
you know, it seems like everything just falls apart. We have places like Baltimore and St. Louis, mm-hmm. and places where people would be foolish to trust many of the police officers there. Mm-hmm. What is in place? You know, Chief Dahl wins the lottery, moves to Thailand. You know, what is in place without your governance, without your oversight, to keep Bellingham from becoming Baltimore?
It's a culture. And, well, and I will to absolutely tell you, I'm the gatekeeper of culture in the organization, but I also tell every one of my first-level supervisors they are also the gatekeepers of culture, to ensure that their police officers are doing absolutely everything correct. I want the next police chief to come from within the organization. I really do. I think succession planning is very important. I've told my police officers this, I'm sorry, your police officers this, just last month, that I'll probably be retired in 5 years. Most of us in the command staff will. What are you doing to prepare to take on a leadership role?
So you are kind of taking an active approach.
Absolutely.
I would love to ask you about 15 billion more questions, and we're unfortunately completely out of time. Chief Dahl, thank you so much for spending the time with us. Tim Johnson, Dave Willingham, excellent questions. I'm Stephanie Contouris, your co-host and producer. Thanks in the booth to Devlin Sweeney and Nick and Alex, who are standing by. And volunteer to be part of the show. Check us out on CascadiaNewsNow.com for archives as well. You are listening to Cascadia News Now on KAVZ 102.5 in Deming, Van Zandt, and KMRE 102.3 FM in Bellingham.